tonight's open call with the organization's external investigator. Just one second, Tanya Banya. And Tanya investigates code of conduct reports that are related to sexual misconduct incidences. We want to make sure that everyone's access needs are met. If you need Espanol or closed captioning to fully participate in the call, please raise your hand or send a message through the Q&A and someone will assist you to connect with those appropriate communication channels. The Survivor Task Force extends its gratitude to our panelists, Daniel Martinez interpreting Leanne Tomlinson, who is the captioner, Stephanie Casco, who is our captain of our show tonight, Tanya Banya, of course, and then also all of the Survivor Task Force members. And all of these folks are going to contribute in making tonight's meeting a success. Subject matter discussed during tonight's open call will involve language and topics about sexual violence and other forms of misconduct. Please practice intervention practices to maintain your safety. Portions of tonight's call is being recorded to offer an avenue all interested Federationists to learn about Ms. Banya's approach to investigating reports. I now turn it over to Catherine Webster for a few other announcements.
Awesome. Thank you, Daphne, and thank you, everyone, for being here tonight. Want to also extend a huge thank you to President Riccobono and our national board, many of which are participating actively on this call this evening. The support and drive forward of a lot of and all of our efforts would not be where we are progressing without the national board's direction and President Riccobono's passion towards what we're doing. Also wanted to just give everyone a quick overview of our programming tonight. So we are gonna hear from our national president, Mark Riccobono, with a brief message. And preceding that, one of our task force members, Mercy Carpenter, will be having a Q&A session with Tanya regarding a lot of the questions that the task force has put together. Preceding that segment is when we will open it up to everyone to ask questions through the Q&A. We've got a few questions that were submitted prior to this evening's meeting, and we also will allow for folks to chime in via the Q&A. Again, please do not share any personal identifiable information during these questions, and also just be conscious of confidentiality and all of the shared agreements that we continue to discuss around consent, confidentiality, safe spaces, and making it a welcoming environment for all. I will now, Stephanie, if you don't mind, playing our opening message from President Riccobono.
Thank you very much for being here this evening to learn about our work to create safety and support within the National Federation of the Blind. I want to begin by showing great appreciation for our Survivors Task Force in the National Federation of the Blind for putting together this meeting to talk about our efforts under our code of conduct and really to celebrate their work since the beginning of this year to improve safety and support within the National Federation of the Blind. It's been an honor to be led by the experience and commitment of these six ladies, and I know they're going to put on a great gathering this evening for all of you. We're here tonight to talk about our code of conduct, which we established in 2018, in January of 2018, and have been socializing throughout the organization. Since that time, we've been making ongoing efforts to improve that code of conduct process, and we've relied on the engagement of members across the country to help make that happen. In January of this year, one of the changes that we made to our code of conduct process was to onboard Tanya Banya, who you will have the pleasure of hearing from this evening and engaging with. Tanya, we asked to be our external investigator for all reports of sexual misconduct within the National Federation of the Blind. Now, that was an important step for us to take as an organization. Our goal in doing so was to ensure that we were doing all that we could to remove bias and conflict of interest from our investigations, and that we were applying the highest standards to our investigatory work to make sure that it was objective as possible. Tanya came highly recommended to us, and I was responsible for signing her up, let's say, getting her agreement in place, and it's a simple agreement. Tanya is charged with taking the complaints that fall into the bucket of things she is supposed to investigate, and she is authorized to go investigate. She asks the Federation for information when she needs it. Otherwise, we get out of the way. Her job is to find whatever truth she can find, and she provides to the Federation a report of her independent findings. It's a significant part of our commitment to safety and support that we brought Tanya on board. And I wanna say a few things about having her with us. One is that it's a leap of faith for us in the Federation, right? Because we're used to taking care of our own business. And to some extent, Tanya is doing that for us. She's carrying a growing understanding of who we are as a movement, but she's investigating these most important complaints of misconduct from her objective seat as an external investigator. And I can say that her reports are extremely thorough. They're fair, balanced, and they're tough. And that is the experience we have asked her for. She's doing a great job for the Federation. She's also doing a great job learning about our organization, the capacity of blind people, and internalizing our understanding that blindness is not the characteristic that defines you or your future. She's only been with us a short time, but I think she's quickly showing that she truly is blind at heart, but not blind to justice. And I really appreciate that she has made the commitment to work with the Federation because she believes in what we are doing as an organization. So I want to take this opportunity to publicly thank Tanya for her outstanding work, and I look forward to a much longer relationship with her as we continue to increase our safety and support efforts in the Federation. Final point, Federation members are essential to our continued work in this area, advising, guiding, helping to continue to improve what we do. That happens from the ground up, from the engagement of individual members. So thank you for being here tonight. Thanks again to our task force for continuing to lead the way and create spaces and opportunities like this for Federation members to be part of this important work. Let's go build the National Federation of the Blind.
Great. Good evening, everyone. My name is Marcy Carpenter. My pronouns are she, her, hers, and I'm a member of the Survivor-Led Task Force. And good evening, Tanya.
Good evening.
So I'm going to be asking Tanya some questions, and so let's get right started with it. Tanya, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, who you are as a person?
Sure. So I am an attorney, although obviously I'm not functioning as an attorney in this context, doing this work, but I am by vocation an attorney. I am a woman of color. I come from a multiracial family. My mom's white, my dad's black. I consider myself black, and I grew up on the East Coast. I was raised Lutheran. I went to Harvard undergrad. I went to Stanford Law School. And I'm a first generation college student in my family. I worked after graduating from law school with big firms for the first decade of my career as an attorney. And about 7, I guess almost 8 years now ago, I started my own practice to work primarily representing individuals whose rights have been violated primarily in the workplace, but in other contexts as well. Because I was troubled by the disparity I saw in the quality of representation available to individuals as compared to the quality of representation available to big organizations. And so I've had my own practice now for several years, and that's what's brought me here with you all this evening.
Great, thank you. And it seems like you've covered your legal expertise and the kind of law you practiced. Anything you want to add about that?
Well, I would add that my primary area of practice is workplace rights. And so in that context, I routinely represent people whose rights have been violated in the workplace as a result of discrimination on any number of improper bases, including race, sex discrimination, disability discrimination, age discrimination. I have also, most of my work, as I mentioned in the last several years and starting my own practice, has been representing individual clients, employees. But I do have a handful of, or I should say a couple of corporate clients. And in both contexts, I have a lot of experience going back now, about 20 years, doing internal investigations, external investigations into allegations of impropriety and misconduct, particularly in sexual harassment and other forms of sexual misconduct. I have primarily represented in that context individuals who have been discriminated against and whose rights have been violated. But I have on, I think I went back and looked at my records, two occasions I have represented individuals who, in my view, had been either falsely accused or of misconduct or had been overpenalized for misconduct. So I have a variety of experience that I think is that I rely on in informing my work for the NFB.
Thanks. So how did you become the external investigator for the NFB? What motivated you to agree to take on this challenging role?
I was recommended for this role by a colleague of mine from Brown, Goldstein & Levy, Sharon Krever Weisbaum, who has worked with the NFB. I have not worked with the NFB before. Was somewhat familiar with the NFB, but not very familiar with the NFB prior to the recommendation. And I believe that the reason that Sharon recommended me for this work is because, you know, the NFB is at a crossroads right now. And, it is not an overstatement to say that for President Riccobono to bring in someone who's never worked with the organization before is a very unusual thing for an organization to do in a position such as the NFB is in at this time. In my experience, and again, I spent the first decade of my career working with big firms where I was representing companies in employment-related matters and other disputes. And it is generally the case that companies bring in known entities with whom they have a long-standing working relationship, because they know that the results are going to be predictable and they know that the outcome is one that they are going to be comfortable with. And that is not the case here, obviously. And it was very important to me, and I was very transparent about the fact that my own integrity and my own values are the primary drivers of what I do in any situation. And I was very upfront about that from the beginning. But you know, when I look at what the issues that have come to light in the last several months and the change that the NFB is going through, it's hard. I know from my own experience working with organizations as a member and as counsel and in a variety of other contexts that organizational change is a very difficult thing to do. And when I look at the work that the NFB does and when I have read, and of course now I know better than ever what it's meant to people and the role that it's played in their lives, I think it's incredibly important for that work to continue. And I know that this is a challenging time, and I'd like to be part of that. But I also would like to be a part of helping the survivors and victims of sexual misconduct who've come forward be able to participate in a process that is a safe one for them, and one that allows them to be heard in a way that is protective of them. And so there's a lot of ways in which I do my work that are very different than most independent investigators. And not quite frankly, I think that you need that if you're going to get through this and come out on the other side better and a safer organization for all of your members. So you know, I quite frankly did not have a lot of availability. Probably none. I've had to clear some other things off my plate as it turned out to be able to do this work and do it the right way. But it's something that I think is really, really important, and I'd like to be part of it.
Thanks. I'm so glad you are. So you mentioned some values. What are other guiding principles and values do you have as a lawyer, particularly around dealing with matters of confidentiality?
Well, you know, I always say, I'm sure that there are people on, you know, participating this evening who've heard me say that you know, equality and justice are really my core values and fundamental fairness. With respect to confidentiality, and particularly dealing with the issue of confidentiality in a setting like this, you know, I would say there's probably three guiding principles that are important and directly relevant to my work as the independent investigator or external investigator for the NFB. First, you know, honesty and transparency. You know, from the beginning of this process and this work, I have made a concerted effort to be clear with people about who I am and what this process involves. From, you know, explaining their options to the participants in the process, their options for confidentiality and anonymity, and the limits on the representations that I make, you know, from the possibility that my records could be subpoenaed to mandatory reporting obligations that may be triggered by the information that they share, to who gets reports. I have always made a concerted effort to be very clear about what the process entails and how it's going to work, because, you know, the information that people share with me every day in my work here and more generally, more broadly, is information that is personal. It is potentially harmful and hurtful to the people who talk with me and to others. And it is a responsibility that I take very seriously to guard that information and make sure that people understand what, you know, what is going to happen and what they're getting themselves into when they participate in the process. And so, you know, making sure that I'm completely honest and transparent with people about how the process works, what I can do, what I can recommend, what I can't do, I think that that's really important because, you know, a lot of the people involved in the process have not gotten that, and they deserve to get it. And that's one, you know, first step to making people feel comfortable and rebuilding trust is to be clear about how things are gonna work. Also, accountability. You know, there are times when people share information with me and I tell them I'm putting my pen down, I'm taking my hands away from the keyboard, and you know, I'm not putting this information anywhere. Because it is information that is, in my view, so sensitive that I don't want to ever be in a position where I have to turn that information over and reveal that information that that person has shared with me in confidence. And so when I say that to people, I mean it. That information is not in my files. If I tell a participant in the investigation that the information is not going to go in my report, it doesn't go in my report. You know, if I tell a person conversely, if I've gotten information from multiple different sources, I tell people I've gotten this from multiple sources and I can reveal it and in the report in a way that you should know this is not pointing the finger at you. I am very careful to make sure that, you know, people know what they're committing to and they know that I'm going to stand behind what I tell them with respect to what I'm going to do with that information and what I won't do. And lastly, compassion. You know, I treat people in all roles in this process the way I would want to be treated. I lose sleep over the decisions that I have to make with respect to recommendations because I know those recommendations are taken very seriously. And may very well guide what the NFB does. And I know that the decisions have significant impact on all participants in the process. And so I make a concerted effort not to include in my report information that is needlessly embarrassing to survivors. But I also do that with respect to the respondents. I tell people that in the process because I don't want to make the process any more painful or triggering for anyone involved in the process than it needs to be. So those are some of the principles that inform how I do my work.
Okay, thanks. Can you walk us through kind of end-to-end process of what it's like when you conduct a code of conduct investigation?
Early on in this work, the NFB set up a process so that when code of conduct complaints are received by the NFB, they are automatically routed to me and also to the chair of the special committee. Usually within 24 hours, and sometimes immediately, we will confer with each other to make sure that we are in agreement as to whether or not a complaint is within my jurisdiction and is one that should be assigned to me to investigate. I don't think that we've ever disagreed, and I know that we err on the side of if there are 10 issues raised or 5 issues raised. And there's one that appears to raise a sexual misconduct allegation, then that would come to me. That's kind of the first thing that happens. And then I will reach out to the person who made the report and let them know that it's been received. I have form kind of emails that I will send out that are tailored to that depend on the person's connection with the report. And so, more recently now there are reports that are being made by mandatory reporters, not only by survivors. And so there are different forms that go out depending on the person's role. But I will reach out to that person and let them know that the complaint has been received, try to coordinate a mutually convenient time for us to talk. And I also will, with, you know, immediately upon getting the complaint, and do kind of a plan of action that is just sort of an initial kind of roadmap for what I plan to do in that particular investigation. All investigations are different and the how extensive or limited they need to be or should be depends on the nature of the allegations and the people involved and the issues. But I will, you know, come up with that plan and identify who I expect to interview besides the person who made the report and the respondent. Usually if there's witnesses, I will plan to interview those witnesses, but I don't always interview. There are times when I don't need to interview the witnesses. And then ultimately the investigation, all the information that I gather, which would also include a request for any documents or information that I need that's in the hands of the NFB or the training centers. That could be policies, procedures, it could be personnel files, it could be student files. But that initial plan for the investigation will identify the various things, the various types of information I believe that I need to review to be able to assess whether the sexual misconduct occurred. And then after I review that information, conduct the interviews, I will prepare a written report. And my written report goes to the NFB.
Great, thanks. And has your process evolved any since you began to work with the NFB code of conduct? And if so, how?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, and I think it's likely it will continue to evolve in some respects because new issues surface and reveal places where the process needs to change and can be better. Early on, the reports were being forwarded to me and were not coming directly to me. And of course that process has now changed so that the reports automatically are forwarded to me upon receipt by the NFB. Early on, I thought that I would be able to circulate witness statements to witnesses so for them to review. It very quickly became clear that that was not workable, just given the volume of people I need to talk to. It just was not manageable. And so now, what I found actually as a practical matter is that most of the information that I rely on and that's central in my findings comes from multiple sources. And if there ever is a question of, you know, critical facts that have only come from one source and needing to ensure that those facts are verified, I'll reach out to the individual witness or witnesses from whom I gathered that information to verify that information is correct. I had started out planning to interview all witnesses identified by the survivor or the respondent. It's become clear that isn't always necessary. And so in cases where there are witnesses who would, you know, likely provide information that is just duplicative of information I've already received. In cases where the respondent has admitted to the misconduct alleged, I will not identify additional witnesses who would simply verify facts, unless the exception being where there are witnesses who are also survivors who have expressed an interest in talking with me, in which case I will always make sure that I speak to those witnesses to give them the opportunity to be heard as part of this process. I'd gotten the recommendation that participants be given, invited to have a representative participate with them if they were interested. And so that is now something that I've been including in my initial correspondence with the participants to let them know that that's an option, to let them know that we're willing to make accommodations that are needed to help them participate in the process. See, I think that that's a pretty good list or sample of the ways in which the process has evolved, and the goal has been to make the process one that is safer and more comfortable for all participants, but especially for survivors.
Thanks, appreciate that. Are reporting parties allowed to withdraw their consent to participate in the investigatory process? Sorry, jumping over my words. And if so, how?
Yeah, so we've kind of been using the term reporters or reporting parties to, generally, typically when I use that language, it's in reference specifically to people who are not victims of the misconduct alleged themselves, but are reporting something that happened to someone else. Reporters, there really isn't, once they report what they know, that's pretty much the end of their involvement, unless they are also victims of the misconduct alleged. In that case, those individuals are always told at the beginning of the process that reporting the misconduct is not required. They don't have to participate in the process to report it. Their involvement can start and end with the report that they make at the beginning of the process. When people are not responsive to me, I will let them know that. That I will infer from their lack of response to me that they don't want to be involved in the process and that they don't have to be. I will also let them know that if they prefer not to be directly involved in the process but would like to get the outcome, that is an option for them. But to answer the question about withdrawal, certainly survivors who make reports through the code of conduct process can elect to withdraw their report, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the investigation would end, because ultimately the process is designed to protect all members. And so once information has been reported that requires action on the part of the NFB, it would still be acted on, but the person who made the report, again, would not need to participate in the process if they chose not to.
Okay. And as far as the survivor, are they allowed to change their mind about remaining anonymous, and how do they do that?
Mm-hmm. They certainly can. I, as a matter of like kind of standard practice, make it a point in my written report to keep most people anonymous as much as possible. I make an effort to avoid attributing information gathered in the investigation to any particular person. But survivors and can certainly elect to be anonymous or not to be anonymous up to the time when I submit my report to the NFB. And so at that point it would be too late. But from the time that I first contact them and they first submit their report up until the time when the actual report is sent to the NFB, they can change their mind.
Okay. And what types of recommendations do you provide for final resolutions to investigations? And what factors contribute to your recommendations?
Mm-hmm. The recommendations that I make are have to be understood against the backdrop of this process. It's the code of conduct process through the NFB provides a certain range of, potential recommendations or disciplinary actions and other types of remedial action that can be recommended, which would include expulsion of the offender or suspension of the offender, If that person happened to be an employee, termination of employment, a permanent ban on employment with the organization, a ban on employment with minors in particular. It could include a recommendation that the offender get harassment training. It could be a recommendation for mental health counseling. It could be a warning, reprimand, a letter of apology from the offender, providing information about support services in the victim's local community. Those are the kinds of corrective actions I've recommended. And then the factors that I look at in making those recommendations include looking at the nature and severity and pervasiveness of the offender's conduct, whether it was sexual harassment or abuse, whether it was merely verbal or if it was also physical, involved physical abuse, if there are clear violations of professional or ethical standards, and you know whether it was consensual or non-consensual, whether it was exploitative, whether the survivor, the victim was a minor or an adult in the offender's care, whether there's evidence of that there's some kind of fiduciary obligation that was violated, and if there's evidence of undue influence or coercion, you know, the person's overall record of employment or membership in the NFB, whether there were applicable policies prohibiting their conduct and whether they were aware, if there's been prior discipline for similar violations, whether the offender was cooperative, honest, and candid in the investigation, and remorseful, and the harm and the impact that their conduct had on the survivor or survivors, whether it was a single incident or part of a larger pattern that occurred over the course of time, the number of victims, the impact to the NFB, risk of future harm to NFB members, and whether there have been any prior efforts at rehabilitation, prior warnings. I think that covers everything.
Okay, thanks. And are you involved in the appeals process at all?
Not really, no. The appeal is, as I understand it, is ultimately handled by a panel. I make an effort in my written report to include all of the information gathered in the investigation that I think would help the NFB understand my findings and my recommendations. But of course, I always make judgment calls. It is not uncommon for my interview notes from interviewing a witness to be, 10 pages of information. And so, I'm always making judgment calls about how much information to include and what to exclude. And so, my goal is to include all the information that would help the reader understand the findings and recommendations. Of course, there's always more information. And so, I have made the NFB aware that I'm willing to, answer questions, or if there's specific information that would be helpful to give context to the findings and recommendations as part of the appeal process, I would be happy to provide that information. But to date, I have not had any involvement in any appeals.
Okay. You've spoken quite a bit about your approach to witnesses and interviewing them. Do you have anything else you'd like to add about, how you approach those conversations and interviews? And you've already kind of talked about if you do interviews and the variations in that.
The only thing I might add that I don't believe I said earlier is that one way that my approach to investigations is probably different than what's more common is that I don't make an effort to be impartial and to keep my thoughts and impressions of the information provided to myself during the process. I believe that it's important to be advocative for survivors, because the reality is that there are so many factors that weigh against survivors ever getting to a place where they're talking to me. And so I know that I've told the task force before, I believe it's important to kind of put your thumb on the scale on behalf of survivors to get to the truth. It's not to taint the result, it is to get to the truth. And I believe that that's necessary because of the sort of societal influences that are a barrier to supporting victims. So when I conduct interviews, I treat survivors and respondents the way I would want to be treated. And so if, you know, I listen to people share with me, you know, their own feelings of guilt and their feelings of shame, and I tell them, I will tell witnesses, I will tell survivors when the respondent has already admitted to what they're telling me. I want them to know that. I want them, you know, if the evidence has shown that this person has, the offender has abused, you know, a dozen people, I will share that you are not alone. And that is an unconventional way to approach investigations. But, you know, it doesn't impact the result. But I do think it makes the process a more humane experience for the people involved. And so, you know, that when I do the interviews, I approach them with the goal of being compassionate and being supportive of people as they, in many instances, re-experience a traumatic event or events. And so I do that by being compassionate and by being supportive. You know, there have been times when, you know, I have shared with people that what they have shared with me that they think has only happened to them has happened, you know, in many other instances. I want them to know that, and I've heard when I've listened to people share with me that they believe something was their fault, and I tell them that it was not their fault. This is not a process about their culpability. It's about what someone else did. So, yeah, I think it's important for people to know. I will also, when people have reservations about participating in the process, I'm happy to speak with them before they even file a complaint, to talk with them about the process, to make sure that they understand what's involved, to make sure that they're comfortable with it. I will invite them to, you know, ask any questions, hear about the process and ask questions and sleep on it. If they want to sleep on the process and deciding whether or not they are willing to speak with me. You know, so those are some things that I do in the interview process to try to make that process more comfortable for participants.
Okay, thanks. And what happens if a survivor or a reporting party doesn't respond to your outreach to them? Do you treat that as an anonymous investigation?
And so, you know, reporters, again, when I use that term, I'm typically referring to the NFB leaders who,
right.
You know, have an obligation to report something that's been brought to their attention. I've never had the occasion to have a reporter not be responsive. But with respect to, you know, people who are reporting misconduct that happened to them, if the person is not responsive, I think I said this earlier, if the person is not responsive, you know, I don't want to not talk to them because they, for whatever reason, didn't get my initial communication, or maybe they overlooked it, or, you know, maybe I had a bad contact, you know, information for them. And so I will follow up but I will, you know, explain to them in that follow-up that if I don't hear from them, that I will infer from that that they don't want to directly participate in the process, and that I will leave them alone, because, you know, as I have experienced, you know, sexual misconduct myself, and, you know, I understand the many reasons why a person would report, but not necessarily be interested in actively participating in the investigation. And throughout the process, you know, I always want to make sure that I'm doing anything and everything I can to respect the agency of survivors.
Sure. And then does that report, does that investigation then go on as an anonymous investigation?
Unless a participant has affirmatively given me consent to disclose their participation in the process, I treat them as confidential.
Okay.
And keep them anonymous, correct.
Okay. What happens if you get additional information or evidence after you've submitted your report?
So, you know, that's an interesting question. I've never had that happen. You know, I think what would happen would depend on the nature of the information received. certainly if it was duplicative of information I already had and didn't have any impact on my analysis and findings and recommendations, you know, I suppose I would make the NFB aware of it if appropriate, but maybe not. If, on the other hand, if it somehow called into question my findings or if it changed the recommendations, then I would certainly reach out to the NFB and make them aware of that. And and I would certainly advocate for a revision to the report and the findings and recommendations.
Okay, thanks. So last couple of questions are a little bit different. You mentioned earlier about losing sleep over, you know, when you have to make a decision. What's the hardest part of this role?
You know, I mean, losing sleep is certainly not fun. You know, the hardest part is the pain that so many people are in and are still in, as a result of the experiences they've had, and of course the experiences that have led to them being involved in this process. You know, I am a very empathetic person, and I think it makes me well suited to do the work that I do, but it's hard, and it can sometimes, you know, cause you to question humanity. So, you know, that's hard. But, you know, what I try to focus on is the strength and courageousness and the resilience of the people who I'm talking with and you know, what they've come through. And I try to focus on that rather than the hurt and the harm and the sort of dark part of the process.
Okay. This is hard work, and I know this as a survivor, we emphasize it with people we speak with all the time about self-care. So what do you do for self-care?
I probably drink too much. I am fortunate that I am in business with my husband. My husband is an attorney and works with me. And he does some work to the extent he can support my work in this role. And so he, of course, is bound by confidentiality. And so, you know, I spend time with my husband and I, you know, I vent to him and share, you know, stories of courage with him. And you know, I spend time with my dog and I hug my dog and talk with like-minded people, you know, about the work that people are doing to address these types of issues, not merely in this context, but you know, in a variety of other contexts. It is as a person who's been practicing law now for almost 20 years, the sea change that I have seen and witnessed in with respect to sexual misconduct and race discrimination and a whole range of issues within the last couple of years, the progress that's been made is staggering. And so, I focus on that and I take stock of those successes. I take stock of that progress, and that helps me immensely. Usually with a glass of wine in my hand, I take stock of that progress.
Understood. So that concludes our this round of questions, but I want to just give you the opportunity if there's anything else you would like to add that we haven't covered before we move on to the next phase of tonight.
I think I've said it, but I think it also bears emphasizing that, I just feel humbled and inspired by the people that I'm working with in the course of doing this work every day. As I mentioned, I've had my own experiences with sexual harassment and sexual misconduct. And so, the strength and the courage that people, that the NFB members I talk to have and that I witness in their participation in this process is just, it's humbling and it's inspiring. And, I hope to, I hope to fulfill what you all want from me in doing this work. And I invite everyone who's involved in the process, who participates in the process, to share with me their feedback on how to make this process better. Because many of the changes that have been made in how I do this work have come directly from you.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate talking with you tonight and getting to know you a little better and helping our members to get to know you a little better. So really, really appreciate your time tonight. Now I'm going to turn it back over to Daphne and Catherine for the next.
Awesome. Thanks, Daphne. I haven't been hearing the announcements, but do recognize that it's recording to the cloud. So just so everyone knows, the recording has resumed. And the first question that we've received is, Tanya, do you mind elaborating a little bit on the difference between substantiated and unsubstantiated reports? And also to that end, if you're able to share any numbers of reports that go against substantiated ones and unsubstantiated ones.
Sure. So substantiated would simply be the outcome when the misconduct that is described in the report has been, I've concluded based on the evidence gathered in the investigation that it occurred as reported. Unsubstantiated can mean a variety of things. It can mean that either that the misconduct as alleged did not occur, so there's no violation of the code of conduct because the misconduct reported didn't occur. It could also mean that although what was reported did in fact occur, it doesn't constitute a violation of the code of conduct. Unsubstantiated doesn't mean that what was reported didn't happen. It can sometimes simply mean that it doesn't rise to the level of something that would be a violation of the code of conduct. And then what was the second part?
Thank you for that, Tanya. Are you able to share numbers of reports that have been filed since you were brought on at the beginning of January?
I don't know. I will say that I have had a number of people ask in the course of the process about, have alluded to, wanting to have transparency around the number of reports made and the outcomes. And I actually just don't know if that's something that the NFB is sharing, and because it's not strictly something that falls within you know, my discretion to decide. I don't know that I feel comfortable saying it, but I will share that I do think that that transparency would be a good thing.
That's helpful. Thank you, Tanya.
The next question from the audience is, are reports available to everyone or only to NFB leadership?
Mm-hmm. The reports don't even go to all NFB leaders. The reports in most cases go to the president, and then there's a committee of three individuals who weigh in on the president's decision, based on the report that I provide. But in most cases, the report would only be viewed by those individuals. And then there's the written determination that's issued by the president that would also include a summary of my findings and my recommendations, and then whether or not the NFB is implementing and adopting the recommendations that I made, or if they're deviating from those recommendations. And that would go to the people who are considered parties to that particular report, which in most cases would be the survivor or reporter, to the extent the reporter is a survivor of the misconduct alleged, and then the person who's the subject of the report.
Excellent. The next question is around submitting, or filing rather, reports to you directly instead of going through the NFB code of conduct process. So is there a possibility to email you code of conduct violations instead of going through the five mechanisms of filing reports?
At this time, there is not. As I think I alluded to earlier, or may have mentioned, there have been times when people have reached out to me independent of the code of conduct process, because my information obviously is publicly available, and they had questions or concerns about the process. But as it exists right now, the process does not contemplate that people would make complaints through me without the NFB being included in that process. That's not something I'm opposed to, but it would definitely require coordination and some discussion with the NFB to, one, approve, and then two, to there would be some logistical issues that would have to be worked out to ensure that there's mechanisms in place to do that. But as of right now, there is not. There's not a process that contemplates that.
Okay. The next question is, what input, do NFB leaders or members have, what input does NFB leaders or members who are not named in a complaint have prior to the final report being issued?
So I'm not sure that I understand the thrust of the question. People who have an interest in it somehow, but are not parties to the report.
So they want to know individuals who aren't named if they play a role in the investigation before you issue your report.
I see. Okay. So, you know, the most common circumstance where someone would be involved in an investigation but not be an actual party is if they're a witness. And they could, you know, it could be someone who is, you know, a witness because they're a coworker. It could also be someone who is another survivor of the same misconduct at issue. And so ordinarily, a person who is not a party to a report wouldn't get the results, and they wouldn't be treated like the parties to the complaint. But if a person, a witness is a survivor, I will certainly, they don't get a copy of the report, but I will ask them the same questions I would ask, I ask the survivor who made the report. And I will make sure that they know when the investigation has concluded, and I will make sure that they know the outcome, like the final outcome of that investigation. And so, you know, one of the things that I always ask the person who makes the report and other people involved in the process is what outcome they would like to see, how they would like to see the report resolved. And so that is a way that the input from people who are not technically parties is taken into account in the process.
Thank you, Tanya. The next question is, and I'm going to read it directly so nothing's misconstrued. What would be an offense that warrants permanent expulsion, lifetime expulsion?
Well, you know, certainly every situation is different. You know, if you think about the list of factors that I mentioned that are taken into account, that I take into account in making recommendations as to discipline. You know, if you're talking about something that was repeated misconduct that occurred over a course of time, where a person has, you know, has been disciplined and has continued to offend. But it wouldn't, that's not necessarily required, because certainly there could be single incidents that were sufficiently severe and traumatic that they would warrant expulsion. So, you know, it really is a case-by-case determination that takes into account all of the factors, all of those various factors that I mentioned. But certainly the most common thing the most common factors that in my view would warrant a permanent expulsion would be repeated conduct after warnings and discipline and continued dishonesty in this process about what happened, victim blaming, denial of responsibility, those kinds of factors would be the ones that would, in my view, would typically warrant an expulsion.
The next question is, what is your standard of evidence? For example, is it preponderance of evidence?
It is, yes, it is. And so, you know, for those who don't know what that means, you know, it essentially means just more likely than not. If you imagine a scale, enough evidence to tip that scale, you know, ever so slightly in favor of one version of events over another. And so, you know, obviously not anything like beyond a reasonable doubt standard that you would see in a criminal context. It's really just, you know, more likely than not.
Okay, thank you, Tanya. The next question is, what would be your answer to the common charge of an external investigator is a hired lawyer representing the interests of the NFB?
Mm-hmm. I would say that in the vast majority of cases, that's true. And a reason to be skeptical of the person's ability to be objective. You know, in my case, I have lots of work. and you know, taking on this assignment with the NFB was something that I did not automatically say yes to. It's something that I had to seriously ponder and sleep on because of you know, and ultimately decided to do, obviously, because of the reasons I've already mentioned. But you know, I'm a very successful lawyer. I have lots of work, and I make a good living doing what I do. And so, you know, I don't need to remain in the NFB's good graces continue to, you know, earn an income. As I mentioned, I have taken some things off of my plate to be able to do this work. And you know, to President Rigabono's credit, when I agreed to do this, as he alluded to at the beginning, it was a precondition of my involvement that I have complete discretion to recommend whatever I think is appropriate. And I've done that. I've done that, and I will continue to do that. And whenever I've had questions or concerns about any aspect of this process and have requested a change, I have not had any resistance from the NFB to making that change, to make the process more survivor-friendly, to make it a more comfortable process for witnesses. Anything that I've ever suggested has been received well and has been accommodated. So I think that it is appropriate to be, you know, to be concerned about whether or not you know, the fact that my bill gets paid by the NFB is an issue, but I don't know who else would pay it if it wasn't the NFB. So I will also say that, you know, I continue to do independent investigations, not as often as I did when I was associated with big firms, in part because most organizations won't hire a person who is a civil rights attorney and advocates for victims to come in and do this role. They won't do it. And the last time I actually did an independent investigation for a big organization was when the organization was involved in advocacy, and it was important to them to have someone who would bring the diversity of experience that I bring to this work, and to have credibility and to for everyone involved in the process. And my integrity and who I am as a person is not something that I would ever sacrifice for to get an assignment and to get paid. It's just not something that I'm capable of doing. And I think that my track record, if you look at the decisions that I've made over the course of my career, bear that out. I've walked away from big law firm jobs to start my own practice. And I sued the biggest law firm in Maryland and took on no other work, and basically didn't get paid for a year and a half because it was the right thing to do. I am not someone who's motivated by money. I'm motivated by justice.
That's excellent, and it's great to hear. This next question, and you can tell me if this is something that is in your wheelhouse to answer. What is the accountability for NFB or offenders if they choose to ignore recommendations or do something different?
I didn't hear the very beginning of the question. What was the first couple of words?
What is the accountability for NFB or offenders if they choose to ignore recommendations or do something different?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the final determination that is issued by the president, I think is a step toward accountability, because by virtue of the fact that that determination includes my findings and recommendations, and also, you know, then shows whether or not those were implemented, that in and of itself is a step toward accountability, because the organization is being transparent about whether or not they are accepting my recommendations or deviating from those recommendations. And then obviously the appeals process is an avenue that allows the parties involved in the process to challenge that decision if they're dissatisfied with it. Beyond that, I don't know that there's any other accountability, but I do think that those two steps are pretty significant, and certainly being transparent about whether the organization ultimately accepts and implements my recommendations is an unusual step.
Thank you, Tanya. Just so everyone knows, we've got three more questions in the queue. So I know we are set to adjourn at 9:30, but wanted to just give a final push. Thank you. I see more coming in. All right. So the next question is, how many witnesses are the survivors / reporting party allowed to include in their initial report? What if the survivor doesn't include a witness?
Mm-hmm. There is no limit on the number of witnesses that can be identified. and it's not a requirement either.
Why has the NFB been experienced such a high incidence of sexual misconduct?
Was the question why?
Yes, why?
You know, I don't know that I am qualified to answer that question. I mean, I could certainly say, you know, that they're, I mean, you know, the NFB is not unique insofar as these are issues that have been underreported and have not always been properly handled broadly. And I think that there are some unique factors that exacerbate the things that contribute to abuse in this particular context. But to say more than that, I you know, this is not something that I've examined, and it's not really something I think I'm qualified to speak to more than that.
Thank you. What is the deadline to submit a complaint?
I know that the deadline for the for lifting kind of the 1 year limit was pushed back. I'm not sure what it is now.
Until August 1st.
Okay. Yep. Good. All right. Good.
So to confirm, if folks want to file a violation against the code of conduct, any time restriction is lifted until August 1st and will be reevaluated at that point. But in the initial language of the code of conduct, it was within 1 year of the incident. Daphne, back to you.
Thank you. So the next question is, give me just one moment because we're getting new questions and it's moving around the focus. Do you think NFB should publish a list of those who have been expelled?
Do I believe that the NFB should publish a list of expulsions?
Expulsions and suspensions.
You're coming in and out a little, Jeff, just so you know.
Is this better?
Yes.
Okay, so do you feel that the NFB should publish a list of individuals who have been suspended or expelled?
I don't, actually. I don't. So, you know, because I have represented people with, I know that discrimination is a significant issue in the blindness community. And I think that it would just become another way that people in the community, another source of potentially inappropriate discrimination against people within the community. I do absolutely believe that the information should be made available to members and to people who should know because of, you know, impropriety that needs to be shared with licensing organizations and things of that nature. but to simply have the information publicly available to anyone, I don't actually agree with that.
Thank you. The next question is, if a lifetime expulsion is issued, is there anything that can undo that aside from an appeal? New presidency, et cetera.
Not that I'm aware of.
Thank you. Want me to jump in, Daphne?
All right. Thanks.
Okay. Sorry.
Oh, no, it's okay. I just switching up my setup here. So the next question is, will you, Tanya, be monitoring whether recommendations are implemented since the general membership will not know the terms of outcomes?
That is a good question. I don't have any involvement in the process after, you know, sending my report to the NFB. And as I mentioned earlier, I would certainly be willing to make myself available, you know, to answer questions if in the appeals process that would be something that's helpful. But at this time, I don't have any involvement in any kind of back end process. I do think that it is critical for there to be mechanisms in place for accountability and transparency to ensure that recommendations and implemented and accepted disciplinary measures are enforced. But at this time, I don't have any role in that process.
Thanks.
If reporting parties decide to opt into being anonymous just from an NFE leadership facing perspective, so not to you, but in terms of the reporting, but still wants to continue within the process, is that a possibility?
Absolutely, absolutely. And that has happened already. There are times when members have shared issues with NFB leaders that they felt comfortable with, who reported those issues on their behalf, and within that process, the person was put in contact with me. And so there definitely are ways if people are uncomfortable with having their involvement in the process in any way memorialized, you know, within the NFB part of the process. There are ways around that.
Great. So then the next question is, what does expulsion actually mean? What is the individual no longer able to do?
Well, as I understand it, and I may not be the best person to answer this question, but as I understand it, a person who is expelled is completely prohibited from participating in the NFB in any capacity. So not only are they prohibited from holding leadership positions and being involved in committees, volunteering, holding employment, they're also ineligible to attend and participate in events. They would not be allowed to participate in any way, shape, or form in any capacity within the NFB.
Thank you, Tanya. That is my understanding as well. All right, the next one is, what is considered reportable in terms of time contrance? Is there a statute of limitation on the period of time that has lasted between misconduct incident and when it is reported?
Well, you know, I think that we just addressed that, and what the information that you shared is my understanding as well, that as of now and through August 1st, the typical 1 year limit on reporting misconduct is not being enforced. And so misconduct that has occurred at any time can be reported through this process.
Thank you. And attendees, just so everyone knows, we have one more question in the queue. So last call for questions this evening. Back to you, Daphne.
Thanks. Just one second. So, Tanya, do you have recommendations for NFB to share de-identified cases that involve minors so that there's level of transparency in the members amongst members so that we can know where we were and where we are now?
I believe I've been, you know, transparent with everyone about with respect to my views on this throughout this process. I think that a part of accountability is transparency. And so, you know, obviously this is ultimately a decision for the NFB to make, but certainly my recommendation would be to provide those kind of those statistics, if you will, so that people have a sense of what, you know, what's been done. And quite frankly, I think the statistics are you know, evidence that the organization is being responsive. You know, there has been some press coverage. There was a report that was talked about in the press. And, you know, if there is anything about this work that has been frustrating to me, it's for people to not understand the extent to which what the NFB has done in engaging me is very, very different from what is typically done in this circumstance. You know, even the other investigation that I mentioned that I did a couple of years ago for another advocacy organization, I made findings, but I didn't give recommendations. It is very forward and a huge step for the organization to not only hire an independent investigator to make findings, but also to give recommendations. And so I think that it may, obviously that is a decision for the NFB to make. And I understand that, but I think that they should be transparent because I think that that people should know what they've done. Because, you know, I came into this and agreed to do this because of my professional respect for Sharon Krever Weisbaum, and because I know her to be a good person, and she knows me. And so I didn't anticipate that she would put me in a position where I would be uncomfortable. And, you know, working with an organization that wasn't committed to doing what it said. And again, my experience has been, I have not had any resistance to any of my recommendations. And as far as I know, I think in all cases they've been implemented. And so I think it would be actually a very positive thing for the organization to be transparent about that.
Thanks. Excellent. So we've got two more questions within the question space on the webinar, and then we also have one hand raised. So we'll go to the two questions in the queue and then to the person whose hand's up. So the next question is, what is the relationship between the special committee and the external investigator, aka you?
Well, so, you know, certainly I do work with the special committee and counsel to the special committee as a necessity. For example, you know, when complaints reports come in, there are reports that raise issues that are primarily related to how a prior report was handled, that raise allegations of silencing of survivors, which isn't really within my purview. But there clearly is a desire to investigate those issues and to address those issues and to hold people accountable. And so when complaints come in, if they raise issues that are not really within my purview, then I will confer with and coordinate making sure that those issues are going to be investigated and looked into by counsel for the special committee. I also will share, you know, although my scope is very narrow and very specific, you know, I have observations about process and policy, and that I have, you know, periodically shared with council, to the special committee, and in some instances to address process things that I thought needed to be addressed immediately. And again, I've found that they've been very responsive to getting that feedback from me and acting on it.
Thanks. So then the final submitted question is to clarify. Did you say that it would make sense, in your opinion, for the NFB to make the list of suspended members available to all NFB members while not making it entirely available to outsiders?
I think that there should be a mechanism for members to access that information and to be able to be able to verify who is suspended and who is expelled. I at the same time do not think that is information that should be tracked or made available in a way that is public facing.
Thanks. And I think Catherine was going to go over to the person with their hand raised.
Yeah, so we also still have two more questions in the queue. And then at this point, so we've got three more, and then we will completely accept no other questions. And I only say that to be respectful of everyone's time, and the door is always open to email us at survivors@nfb.org. And even if those questions are for Tanya, we'll make sure to connect with her and get your questions answered. So we will do the